Podcast, a show about Indiana politics, history, and culture from the unapologetic perspective of the Hoosier left. My name is Scott Aaron Rogers, and I'm recording from Bloomington. Today, I continue my series on the Monroe County Board of Commissioners races. To reset, in Indiana, each county is governed by a three-person board of commissioners who essentially serve as both the legislative and executive branches of county government. Additionally, each county is also served by a seven-person county council who control the purse strings. And obviously, the county courts comprise the judicial branch. As for the commissioners, each member of the board represents the district in which they live, though all county residents can vote for all three districts. In Monroe County, districts 2 and 3 come up for re-election every 4 years on the presidential cycle, while district 1 comes up in midterm years. This year, incumbents Julie Thomas of district 2 and Penny Givens of district 3 are facing aggressive Democratic primary challengers. As I've mentioned several times over the last few weeks, Monroe County, home to Bloomington and Indiana University, is almost entirely under one-party Democratic administration. Therefore, the May primary largely determines the winner come November. Challengers Peter Iverson of District 2 and Jody Madera of District 3, with substantial financial backing from local builders, have attacked the incumbents as obstructionists, beholden to NIMBY homeowners and rural county residents. In response, incumbents Thomas and Givens have characterized the upstarts as being puppets for the real estate developers. Additionally, longtime Bloomington City Council member Steve Volan lurks in District 3. I spoke to Julie Thomas a few weeks back in Episode 26, while interviews with Iverson and Madera have just dropped in the last week. That's Episodes 30 and 31. I recommend catching up on all of those before coming to this installment, but it isn't necessary. My guest today is Penny Givens, Monroe County Commissioner since 2019. From her website. Penny Givens grew up in Richmond, Indiana. After graduating from Purdue University in 1972 with a degree in chemistry and math education, Penny served in the Peace Corps in Kenya for 2 years. Upon her return, she attended IU, earning a master's in educational psychology. Penny has held faculty research positions at the Yale School of Medicine and Vanderbilt University, been involved in program development at the Wharton School of Business, and served as a project manager at the IU School of Education. She is the co-author of 2 books and multiple professional journal articles. Penny has also been active in autism advocacy for decades, serving as a previous board member for the South Central Indiana chapter of the Autism Society of America from 1999 to 2007, and for the Autism Society of Indiana from 2003 to 2005. She has also volunteered as an educational advocate with InSource and been an active member of several Democratic organizations in Monroe County. Penny is also an avid supporter of Hoosier Hills Food Bank and Pantry 279. In this interview, we'll talk about all of the big county issues, annexation, where to erect a new justice center, and balancing the need for more housing with the need to protect the environment. Penny and I also discuss the nasty tenor the campaign has taken on. As I've studied this race in depth, I've begun to make sense of the divisions in the local party, which both reflect and diverge from divisions in the Democratic Party at the national level. More thoughts on that later. But first, this plea for your support. You know, I've been trying to make a full-time go of this project for the past couple of months. After my 19-year-old son passed away in January, the day-in, day-out grind of handyman work just didn't seem important anymore, and I doubled down on Who's Left in an effort to shed more light on state and local politics, where Indiana's Republican supermajority and their financial benefactors work to enact policies that ensure more Hoosier parents note the grief of losing a child, whether through lax gun regulation, bullying queer youth, or poisoning our environment, or simply running the next generation out of state with their draconian policies. I've received an outpouring of support. Our subscriber base has grown tremendously, and we're picking up paid subscribers all the time. I've been able to publish more frequently, learn new skills, and expand beyond audio into video podcasting. But the cushion has run out. My wife and I have exhausted our savings, and I've had to don the Carhartt once again, returning to work, repairing, remodeling, and renovating, working on this project whenever I can. I will continue to work to highlight Indiana's bad actors so we can replace them with more empathetic leadership, and also shine the spotlight on the Hoosier activists, organizations, and elected officials who are doing the hard work to build a more just, equitable, and compassionate Indiana for the next generation of Hoosiers. And I'll take on Democrats, too, when they put their donors over their voters, when they talk out of both sides of their mouths, and when they fail to push back against GOP authoritarian extremism with the necessary urgency and tenacity. I will go deep to provide information and analysis you won't get anywhere else in the Hoosier State, but I cannot devote anywhere near the amount of time it takes to do this well without you. I am not motivated by the dollars, but you know everything costs money. Web hosting, equipment, editing software, travel to meet with other activists and organizers, and most of all, time. I'd much rather devote my time to this and to you, but I need your financial support with a paid subscription over at scottaaronrogers.substack.com. For $5 a month or $50 a year, you can help me push our state in a better direction and help me keep the lights on. And while the best way to help is a financial contribution, if you can't afford it at this time, you can still help. Subscribe at the free level over on Substack. Set your favorite podcast player to auto-download new episodes of the show. Rate and review the show on whatever platform you use. Follow me on social media at facebook.com/whosleft, that is H-O-O-S left. I'm also now on Blue Sky at the same handle. I'm personally at ScottRog78, that is ScottRog78 on Instagram, Threads, and Twitter, and on Mastodon at ScottRog78 at Hoosier.social. Do you want to see my face for some reason? I'm now posting full episodes on YouTube and clips on TikTok. The handle on both of those is at Who's Left. Please, subscribe. But most importantly, share our message. Forward the articles to friends, family, and colleagues. Don't just like, but share on social media. Nobody is coming to save us. We have to save ourselves. With your investment, a full-time Who's Left could look like new content every day, full coverage of the 2024 election cycle in Indiana and beyond, and zooming out to see how networks acting in our state function nationally and even globally. And even though I'm here asking you for money, I do not plan on paywalling any content because, as one of my favorite authors, Sarah Kendzior, Masters from IU Bloomington, says, it's not cool to paywall political content in a political crisis. I believe in open access to information, and your support helps make that knowledge freely available to all Hoosiers, but I desperately need your contributions in order to keep bringing you this meaningful content. So please, before this interview, pause right now, go to scottaaronrogers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level. To those who have contributed already, my sincere thanks. And to everybody, thanks for listening. Now here's my interview with Penny Givens. Penny Givens, thank you for joining the Who's Left podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Scott.
So before we get started here, let's all get on the same page and will you introduce yourself to our listeners here?
Well, thank you. I am Penny Givens. I am Monroe County Commissioner currently. It's a position I've held for 5 years. And I realized last year as I was considering whether or not to run for re-election that there are things I still really care about and want to see through. And that's why I'm seeking re-election. My husband grew up in Bloomington. We moved back here 32 years ago. It's where we wanted to raise our kids. And I'm glad we made the move.
Very good. Well, so you mentioned there are some things that you didn't get to finish here in your 5 years on the Board of Commissioners. So we'll get into those. Talk about your time there on the board, challenges, accomplishments, and then, yeah, get into those couple things that you haven't been able to complete yet that are really driving you to seek re-election.
Sure. Well, first of all, no one person does something. It is there's a three-person board, and you have to have at least two of those members agreeing to something to get anything done. The Board of Commissioners is responsible for the administrative and the kind of rulemaking policy setting of the group. We do not do anything related to finance or the fiscal part of county government. So that's important. We've had two huge watershed events over the last 5 years, COVID-19 pandemic, and then that was followed by the federal government pushing out a lot of money through the American Rescue Plan Act. And so trying to work with the county council on how that money is spent has taken up, you know, some real time. But we've been very deliberative about that. One of the things that I have championed is expanding childcare within our community. The Bloomington Economic Development Corporation estimates that we need to double the number of childcare slots here to really help working families. And so we have used $1.2 million of the American Rescue Plan Act money to that end. So that's something that I'm very, very proud of that we've done. During the pandemic, we worked with people throughout the community, with IU, with the mayor, with IU Health, with our own health department, at the beginning also with our emergency management group, because this was something that nobody had planned for, and we really weren't prepared for it, quite frankly. And so how do we best see that, you know, our community through that? So we knew that anything related to tourism was going to be hurt through the pandemic because everything shut down. Nobody was traveling. So we took some of the food and beverage tax money that had been collected and used it for grants for small businesses that were doing tourism-related businesses. And I found out things that, you know, I would never would have known otherwise, things like about half of the weddings that occur here at sort of the big event places and stuff, they come from people from out of town. A lot of IU graduates who have met here, they come back to get married here. So it's a multi-million dollar business for this community when you think about the event venues, the flowers, the caterers, you know, the hotels, just everything that feed into that. So I'm really pleased that we were able to help some of those small businesses stay afloat during that time. That, I think, made us economically stronger as we came through the pandemic. As we then also, when CARES money became available during the pandemic again, we provided support to small businesses to help them with some of the issues like new air filtration systems and restaurants that suddenly had to turn to take out. So they were spending money on those kinds of supplies. But again, to try to help people keep businesses afloat, keep businesses open, some of them had to shift from storefronts to online. So there were a lot of different things that people were doing and being very creative mm-hmm. to make that happen. We also made additional money available to our township trustees to help people who are struggling, people that need help paying for the rent, paying for utilities. And basically for a while, we were able to double the amount that township trustees could help people with. And they said that made a difference, it kept people housed. And as we came out of the pandemic, there was a point when I was on a call with people from around the state. And as we talked about how we'd gotten through it, people were like, oh my gosh, you guys did things nobody else in the state did. And sort of the totality of it was what was surprising. We had a mask mandate and restaurants and bars said our servers shouldn't have to serve as sort of the police of this. We said, okay, so we hired a company that went around and encouraged people to use masks, for example. And yeah. That allowed businesses to stay open again. I know I was talking with one bar owner who said if one of his people got sick, they had to close for 2 weeks during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things, I think, made a real difference in responding to the community.
I want to ask about that, especially because it sounds like you're using a lot of grant money, so not repayable.
Right.
Yeah, to help out small businesses, keep them afloat. And now I could be wrong, correct me on this, but it definitely seems like the local chamber of commerce, i.e. the representative of all those businesses, has aggressively endorsed, and I don't know if endorse is the right word, but they've definitely taken a side in this race on behalf of the insurgent candidates, if you will. Is that accurate?
I believe it is. Yes, that they are looking for change. That they feel that maybe other things need to be done at this point. One of those you alluded to earlier was housing. We know that there needs mm-hmm. to be more housing for businesses to thrive. We would like to see more, at certain levels too, because if you work in Monroe County but live in one of the surrounding counties, your income tax goes to those counties. So, yes, we know that we could increase our tax base by maintaining people here. An ROI study indicated that we would need at least 7,000 more housing units by 2030. Mm-hmm. I think we're at least partially on our way there. We had several thousand apartment units open up in 2023. There's more scheduled to be open, this year. And we see them going up like at the corner of 446 and 46 and north of town, south of town. There's a lot of apartment units going up. The commissioners several years ago approved the Westgate apartment complex out on West 3rd Street, mm-hmm. which I think is 330 units. We approved a rezone down in Harrodsburg. We have not just said no to different things, but right now we have our hands tied because any development that occurs outside the city limits, you either have to have a sewer hookup or you have mm-hmm. to have at least 1 acre per state code to have a septic system. And right now the City of Bloomington Utilities is not providing any sewer hookups for us. We have been looking at putting in a new habitat, or working with Habitat, I'll put it that way, on a new development. It would be 72 houses that would be done with Habitat and a private developer just south of town. I mean, maybe not even a quarter of a mile outside the city limits. And mm-hmm. we've been told no, that there will be no sewer hookups. And that's because of the annexation fights that are going
on. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is a couple of the issues I wanted to talk about here, sort of overlapping with the housing and the annexation. And let's talk a little bit more about the housing here in a bit. So about the annexation and the sewer hookups, you have been the you've led county residents against annexation, right? So
I wouldn't characterize it as having led the county residents against annexation. I certainly support them because I feel that that's the will of the people that live in those areas. And, you know, the majority of them have said, we don't want to be annexed. And right now, there's a civil suit going on. The city against the people who reside in areas 1A and 1B. And then also the city has a suit against the state because of waivers. And you'll notice that neither of those suits is against the Board of Commissioners.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, being supportive of something does not mean that I have a direct impact on.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for clearing that up. So, but I guess with that being held up in court, we can't really blame the city for like not wanting to expand at the moment, sort of until that's cleared up. I mean, I guess that makes sense. Let me tell you about like my situation personally and see where that would fit in. I'm a county resident. I live outside of city limits, maybe a mile less. I am on city water and city sewer. When we bought our house, we had that clause in there that said, hey, you're on city water and city sewer. If there's an annex, fair enough. So when that was all going on, I didn't take like a strong stance on the issue. I figured, well, yeah, we're kind of locked in. Am I reading that wrong? Are a lot of the people who are contesting this under those waivers? And do we really have any standing?
I honestly don't know what those numbers are. I don't want to make something up for you. I know that a fair number are not on the waivers, and there are people who are on the waivers that didn't realize that they bought a house that had that waiver attached to it. You know, because sometimes it'll be the developer that signs off on that waiver before the house is ever built, even. And sometimes, you know, it's a previous homeowner who did that. And I understand, because I think sewers are environmentally a much better way to go versus a septic system. You know, they're better for the environment. So I think one of the things we're going to have to look at doing is a sewage package plant was put into place in an area called North Park, because that's where it was anticipated originally that the hospital would be built. And so we are going to start to look at whether or not that can be used for some housing out in that area, because then we wouldn't have our hands tied by what's going on with the City of Bloomington utilities. It's just a reality that, yes, we need more housing, but we can only do so much with some of this. We are going through a process creating a comprehensive development ordinance. And some of the areas in the county, yes, they're taking acreage off the areas where homes can be built because they're in floodplains. And if you, as a homeowner, you don't want your house in a floodplain, or business owner for that matter. But we're also looking at areas that could be as dense as six houses per acre. So but we've got to have that, you know, some kind of package plant or sewer hookup to make that possible. It is its own sewer hookup. Yeah. I mean, it's a processing facility for your sewer.
This is kind of fascinating, just as from an infrastructure standpoint. Like, I mean, what happens to the output to that from that? It still has to go somewhere, right? Does that go to the Dillman processing area, or
no?
How does that work?
It's my understanding that you have to have a stream of some sort, some kind of waterway that Some of the liquid can be carried away in, but it is processed to take, you know, the harmful things out of the system for you. It's not just flushing stuff into a river.
Okay, yeah, I would hope not.
Yeah. We need to take care of our downstream neighbors for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That stream runs not very far from my house.
Yeah.
So, okay. So we see how the annexation thing and the housing sort of work.
Just build seem to be what was coming from the your opponent in this race, and they are painting you and your fellow incumbent Julie Thomas as obstructionist and like only representing a narrow slice.
I feel like the race has gotten very mean, just very mean. And I've had fingers pointed at me that are inaccurate at times. You know, we had David Jenner come before us on a rezone out at the Fieldstone area. He wanted to have it rezoned from housing and dense housing to self-storage. And we said no. This was a year or so ago, we said no because that should be where housing goes in, where housing is.
Yeah.
It's right next to already dense housing, already have sewer hookups. And again, we can't get additional sewer hookups out there. And some of the residential areas out there, it's very dense. And I've walked it. I've, you know, been out there. And so it felt right to keep that as a dense area of population. And of course, that's out just west of where Cook is located and some other, it's close to other manufacturing and businesses and stuff. We also, you know, when we talk about housing, part of the problem is that wages in this area have not kept up with some of the cost of living here. So I felt really good also about voting for a tax abatement for enhanced semiconductors. They're a new business that's coming into town, taking over some unoccupied, you know, plant space. And they anticipate up to 250 jobs, average salary of $100,000 and starting salary of $70,000 for the kinds of work that they do. And then they're also going to have a facility down at Crane, which does stuff for slightly more military, I understand, purposes. Terms of the product, but we felt good about working with that company to make these kinds of things happen, because when we talk about growth, we want good paying jobs. I believe that economic growth in the private sector should be providing jobs that provide security to people. And if you're living on the edge all the time, it doesn't feel very secure.
Now I'm a good leftist. I'm wary of tax abatements for corporations in general. It's like, hey, yeah, thanks, welcome to town, guys. But like, if they're not paying their full tax burden, is it worth it? For those businesses to come into the city.
Well, this business is coming into the county, not into the city. We wouldn't have been the ones doing the tax abatement otherwise.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that can be done in these kinds of arrangements is if they don't meet their obligation, that then we should have ways to either claw back some of the abatement or to cancel it, because it's something that's done over time. And in this particular situation, it was done just on the personal property that went with the business. So yeah, there are ways to protect, I think, the taxpayers and the residents of Monroe County with these kinds of challenges, if you will. That's certainly, though, if you're okay. Competing with other places for something, you have to be cognizant of that.
Yeah. Just the fear, I guess, in something like that is, you know, these big businesses will pit localities against each other in a race to the bottom until they essentially have no tax burden wherever they wind up going, right?
But we were very lucky with this particular business in that there is a nice kind of symbiosis. It's with the IU Luddy School and then also Crane, because there are multiple pieces here that made this attractive that other people couldn't necessarily compete with. Another thing that we are looking to do, and I've been asked to serve on kind of the initial advisory board, is to upgrade the Monroe County Airport. And they had a public meeting a month or two ago, and the commander from Crane was there. And he said, yes, we would like to be able to fly in and out of the airport here in Monroe County. You know, it saves them an additional hour each way, better than flying into Indianapolis. There are times when they might like to stage things from our airport. So the goal is to have a slight lengthening of one of the runways, I think, but also a new terminal. From the reactions that I saw, we have two fixed base operations there, Cook and I believe IU. I'm not sure about the other one. Sorry, but they're in favor of doing this kind of thing. So the Airport Authority is looking to get some grant money from the Regional Opportunities Initiative to help with this.
Here a little less than a month ago when they had that eclipse, and we had a lot of private planes come in, and the commissioners had to sort of handle that.
No, the airport, I mean, we got a report on it, and I got some incredible pictures because they put a drone up and were taking pictures of how the airplanes were parked and all this. But yeah, it was fun. They had made arrangements for a food truck to be out there. The planning was really extensive for that. Carlos Laverty, the director out there, he had contacted, you know, airports like in Tennessee that had been through this several years ago, said, what should we be doing, blah, blah, blah. So they, for people that had reservations, they basically said, they told people, half an hour before the full eclipse, nobody's going to be landing in this airport or taking off for that matter. And then for a certain period of time afterwards, only takeoffs would be allowed as well. So he had really thought through it and done his homework on this, which is really fun to see. There was one specially equipped 737, I think, that came in. And normally those are planes that hold well over 100 people, and this was outfitted to luxuriously for 10 people or something like that. So yeah, several stories to tell about this, which were fun.
Well, yeah, that's just an impressive like planning, logistics, just all of it. I know we watched the eclipse that day, and you know, that half hour or so after it was over, the sky just filled up with the with planes taking off. They did a phenomenal job there. I want to jump back to housing now, and this is like young families starting out. And that's one of the big criticisms I hear from your opponent and her, I guess, block partner, as it were. How do we address that and protect, you know, the environment and stay out of floodplains and everything else?
Well, as I said earlier, one of the things that I personally would like to see is some development out in the North Park area. And I think that that's very doable. You know, one of the other big thing, the other elephant in the room, is the Monroe County Jail. And of course, we had looked at multiple locations, and I'll tie this back to housing, don't worry. You know, we had looked at multiple locations, and one of those locations was the Hopewell area. Well, hopefully soon there will be 700 housing units there, which starts to fill in some of that. Travis Venzel with the Summit Development, there, he's gone before city council for, I believe it was up to 4,250 units. Now, those will take time to build, of course, but there, those are, that's going to be mixed residential is my understanding for both of those. And so hopefully that will start to fill in some of those areas. But, you know, we had asked about Hopewell for the jail, and we were told no. And I think that that's not unreasonable, quite frankly, for housing. And so the other big thing that I hear from one of my opponents is that he can get the jail built in a year and keep it near the downtown. That's not really feasible. I'm sorry. If you talk to the experts, and that's what we've been doing, we've hired a design firm. If we were to have a single-story jail, which is what is being built, you really don't want a jail that relies on elevators because elevators break down. You can have two-story unit within, you know, in terms of each living pod per unit, but you don't have a jail that's multi-story the way ours is. And if we're to have that and co-locate the justice kind of group, whether it's the courts or probation or prosecutor, we have been advised that we would need about 25 acres. And there's no place inside or near the downtown where there's 25 buildable acres that we could tap. We've asked the city for help trying to find that, but we can't use the current footprint. It's just not feasible. And of course, the current jail is just structurally, it's not the kind of thing that you want to add on to.
Sure. Well, you mentioned North Park then, which is, I understand, the area where you're looking at
correct
currently for the jail. And then the other area, I guess, that's been talked about a lot, and there have been a couple, but in the so the concern I get there is, well, you know, if we build this, you know, justice facility out there, how are people gonna access those to the services, like the wraparound services that would ideally be put right there with the jail?
Yeah.
At Palm Street, at RCA. Now, there's a lot that would go into even a starting building. I got a large amount of earth that would be moved in. You got some high voltage lines there. But on the other hand, at least that's like.
We were told that it would be a minimum of 2-year delay to reroute those high voltage power lines. That's a minimum. And we don't think that we can be moving that 8-acre debris mound during that time as well. That mound, I've been told, is 53 feet high. And it would also incur over $1 million cost to do that. We would also have to buy a small area, I think it's 5 acres, that is right adjacent to that we don't currently own. Part of the problem with Thompson also is access. You know, we can't widen Rogers Road, really, with the way things are built down there.
No.
And we cannot get access easily off of Rogers Road anyway because of the Duke Power substation that's down there. So we can't get an easement to go off of Rogers. So it starts to be a little logistically difficult. Just in terms of how you get in and out of that area. But we also went down and had 2 community meetings with nearby residents. So one of the things that really stood out to me was they said that Summit Elementary School is now the largest elementary school in the MCCSC group, and that at drop-off and pickup time, traffic just comes to a standstill. And it's very difficult to move around. And so you don't want to have situations where you have to, on an emergency basis, move people in or out of the jail, knowing that there's going to be a lot of traffic, you know, problems that it would just exacerbate what's already going on down there. I'm really pleased that so many people want their kids at Summit. You know, I love the Spanish immersion program that they run down there. But I, you know, we listened to our residents down there also. So
I guess that's one of the nice things about North Park is that you don't really have any neighbors that can complain.
If new housing goes in, then you are buying that house knowing that the jail is there. But it's interesting that because it's actually safer living close to a jail. And I would bet if you walk downtown, you don't even stop to think about your safety when you're near the justice building. It's a non-issue, right? And in fact, because there's generally more law enforcement presence, areas around jails tend to be safer. Up in Hamilton County, there's a high school and an elementary school very near their jail. And there's not a problem, you know. So I just think there's, I think too, and I've said this in public meetings, that once we vacate that justice center, the current justice center, we could be using that for private business. Or, you know, a developer could come in, buy it, create something downtown, no matter what it is, could be a hotel, whatever. But that's going to, I think, drive other business downtown. We don't have our jail staff going downtown to eat their lunch. I mean, they just don't do that, right? They're we don't have a lot of county employees going to the downtown restaurants or downtown shops to shop as part of their daily lives. But I think if there were private businesses in there, that might start to happen. That it actually may help to rejuvenate the downtown area.
Okay, and we're back.
Okay. Well, I wanted to add too that if we're not using the Thompson property for a jail or, you know, justice campus, that then makes it possible for us to be talking about using that for housing in that area. And as you've noted, that is closer to other things. I think too, with the North Park area for the jail, there is very good access via 69 and State Road 46 into that area, and we will solve the transit issue. It seemed a little silly to me to object to the Fullerton Pike area, you know, part of the council saying that transportation wasn't there. Well, of course, transportation wasn't there. There was nothing out there for a bus service to take care of. We didn't even have the road finished, you know. A bus couldn't have gone there. But we will work out the transit system as we move forward with this. We are actually going to have to work out some things with Rural Transit and the county and Ellettsville and Bloomington Transit on routes, especially between Ellettsville and Bloomington at this point because of changes in federal guidelines and funding for things. So that's something that's in progress, and it'll take a while to get ironed out, but it's something that we know needs to be done. But we can easily work on the transit issues. And I'll remind you too right now that in-person visits of family members to inmates is not occurring in our jail. It's all electronic, all virtual. So I don't think that that's a reason to cite for where you're going to locate your jail.
So if the residents of Monroe County return you to the Board of Commissioners for another 4-year term, are we going to have shovels in the ground with this jail starting to be built in the next 4 years?
I certainly hope so. You know, we're going to have to work with our colleagues on the county council to figure out the funding. I know that we have started to, the design firm has started to collect information on what kind of space needs there are. They had a meeting on Friday with different parts of the justice system to say, okay, how many people do you have now? What are your space needs? What do you envision going forward? You know, we have to talk about how many restrooms to put in something. We have to talk about storage space. We have to talk about it, a much improved sort of medical room, or, you know, medical facilities at a new jail.
Yeah.
Right now, the programming space in the current jail is just completely inadequate. I've gotten to tour around to other jails, and certainly what we're seeing is programming in the day rooms, space for programming. We're seeing a completely different approach taken to inmate oversight, and that requires some additional space for doing things. One of the places we heard, though, is that they didn't build in enough storage, and so it's not just storage for, say, the bedrolls or the toilet paper that you have to have in a jail, but it's also storage for your personnel in terms of where they keep their personal items. And so we looked at a facility up in Columbus, Ohio, a new jail that Franklin County is building. My goodness, they put in sort of a gym for their staff with wonderful lockers and for your personal stuff where you can plug in your phones inside your locker and just all kinds of little things that we don't have in our current jail. And that would be, I think, also make it a more positive place for people to work. Because we have to consider that too.
Yeah, it really sounds like, and not, you know, between the employees and the, you know, the inmates in the jail, that Monroe County is a really progressive community. We believe in like rehabilitation over just incarceration and punishment, right? And that our jail in its current form is sort of letting us down. It's not letting us live up to our values.
Correct. Correct. And even with when I talk about multi-story and the current jail, there's only one outdoor rec area in that jail. And in these modern jails, while it may not be completely outdoors, they let in fresh air. There's a lot more sunlight. Sunlight's really important for our mental health. And I know when the current sheriff took over, one of the things that he and his staff did was they put clocks around. Because before, those that were incarcerated didn't even necessarily know what time of day it was. And so there are a lot of just little things that make a place more humane.
Yeah, you don't think about that, but like being indoors where it's kind of, you know, you always have the same amount of like fluorescent light, it really messes with your circadian rhythms. It's a mental health issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to talk about your opponents a little more and the tenor of this race and the nastiness. And I got a flyer from you and Julie the other day talking about the large amounts of developer money that a couple of your opponents are taking. And it certainly seems like what's the word I want to use? I don't want to say anybody's bought, you know, because campaigns cost money, right? And our town needs housing. But what is the issue, in your opinion, with a couple of the opponents in this race being so funded by home developers?
Campaigns need money, and so some people, I guess I know that one of the developers is very unhappy with the fact that we turned down his request for a rezone, and this is Tom Wininger at the Southern Meadows area specifically. And you know, we had firm rationale for why we turned that down. First of all, we always listen to the neighbors, and it's not just those that appear in public. I get emails, I get calls from people about these things too. With the Southern Meadows development, there was large concern about additional traffic on Rogers, because it would go from, I think it was 95 to 190 homes. And so that it's not just the people that live there, but there's mail delivery, there's school bus pickup, but there's deliveries from whether it's UPS or Amazon or whatever it is. And there are estimates that it leads to like six additional, each additional home would be linked with six additional vehicles in and out of that development every day. So traffic was a real issue, but also there are a lot of karst features down in that particular location. And I was quite worried about damage to the karst, and also karsts are evolving. They're not static. And so you have to worry about what that does. If it enlarges, you have to worry about the water runoff that occurs with all this and where that runoff goes, because a lot of this is linked underground to other things and then comes out at Hidden Creek. I forget the name of it. I'm sorry. But there are issues that are environmentally that you have to pay attention to with all these things. Yes, we also, Tambi Michael Cassidy came before us with her blind squirrel development on South Rogers. She had a specific idea in mind for what she wanted in a development there. We asked her to make it a bit less dense. She went back to the drawing board and came back to us with something that we approved down there. There was also another development that we turned down, and it was because of water and water retention, detention ponds. And the fact that we didn't feel comfortable with the plans for the housing, the HOA that they were proposing to ensure that, those kinds of detention ponds would be properly maintained. We're seeing problems with that in other areas of the county that we're going to have to go and figure out ways to upgrade some of the things that are going on. And we have to be good stewards of what our current residents have and want as well. We don't want damage to existing homes and businesses from development.
As I sort of listen to you here today, and I've talked to some of the other candidates in these races, sort of like the overarching idea that I'm putting together here, at least what I'm hearing from you, is that maybe these upstarts have a lot of ideas, right? They want to be really aggressive and get this done and get this done and get this done and this done. But once you're in the office, sounds like you bump into a lot of little details and just like little realities here and there. And you have to take all of these things into consideration and be really thoughtful and just check a lot of boxes. And as much as you want to be aggressive and get things done quickly, you still have to be deliberate and thoughtful and slow things down and say, hey, wait a second, let's check out everything. Am I on to something?
Right. I mean, when we talk about septic systems, there can be health issues with that, right? I learned recently that, for example, there are a lot of septic systems out around Lake Lemon. And remember, Lake Lemon used to be the water source for Bloomington and Monroe County. Well, at times when they go out and do E. coli sampling, they list it as TNC, which is too numerous to count, okay, in terms of the E. coli. And yes, I would never, well, that's me personally, about what I would not. Athletic Lemon. But they said, well, maybe that's just because of deer and wild animals and stuff. So they actually did some DNA testing, and about half of that E. coli is sourced from human waste. So you do have to be really careful about these things that people think of as details, but they're not. They impact all of us on a regular basis. You know, right now we're involved with the Hoosier Forest Alliance and Hoosier Environmental Council and the Friends of Lake Monroe in a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service because they have proposed clear-cutting, burning, logging, and application of glyphosate in the part of the Hoosier National Forest that's in the Lake Monroe watershed. Well, that impacts 140,000 residents. That's our water supply. And we have to stop and look at history. You know, Griffey, Lake Griffey was the water supply for a while, then Lake Lemon. Now we're at Lake Monroe. And Lake Monroe was not built as a water supply. It was built for flood control by the Army Corps of Engineers.
But what happens? Not a word.
Yeah. What happens if we lose Lake Monroe as our water supply? Where do we go next? So we have to think generations ahead in some instances, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing when we talk about the jail. Jails have a lifespan of at most 30 years, generally. They're used hard, 24/7. I mean, they, mm-hmm. yeah. And so we have to be thinking not only of the jail that we want to see in place in a couple of years, but also is there expansion space years from now? Is there a space that once the new jail is beyond its usable life, that there's already space right there to build something new? So we are trying to think years ahead, and we can do development, but we need to be very thoughtful about how we do it. Certainly, if for people that have children, if you want your children to stay here, they deserve clean drinking water. They deserve the other things that we take for granted at this point.
All right, so we're coming up on the end here. Why don't you go ahead and give us the big pitch here, Penny? Tell us why Monroe County should elect you to another 4-year term here.
Well, I told you at the outset, I decided to run again because I care. I truly care about what happens to all residents. I live inside the city of Bloomington, so it's not that I am, you know, only representing the people that live in the rural areas. I know that, like, our health department takes care of all the residents. I know that our jail is there for all the residents. So there are a lot of things that I have become very aware of in the last 5 years. We have received money from the federal government through the opioid settlement things that have gone on. I want to be there to help shepherd through what that is used for. We still have some ARPA money that we need to figure out what to do with. I want to be there to help shepherd that through. I feel like I have learned a lot, that I have a lot of knowledge that I can want to continue to put to use. And also, I treat this as my full-time job. And I make myself available early in the morning, late in the evening. I do things on the weekends. I've had a couple of instances where I get a call saying, Penny, can you be up in Indianapolis to talk before the state legislature about issues that impact Monroe County? And I'm there. I don't have to say, oh, can't do it because I've got this other job, or can't do it because of A, B, or C. I make myself available. I dedicate myself to this job. And so that's why I would like to have the support of the community going forward.
Very good. Where can our listeners find out more about your campaign?
At PennyGivensForCommissioner.com.
Very good. Coming up on Election Day here, everybody make sure they get out and vote. However you vote, just participate, be active in our community. And Penny Givens, thank you so much for joining the Who's Left podcast. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate you reaching out to me. This is good.
All right. Thank you, Penny. Once again, that was incumbent Monroe County Commissioner Penny Givens facing a tough primary fight May 7th. After talking with challengers Iverson and Madera recently, I was interested to hear the other side of this intra-party squabble from Givens. Speaking to Penny, I hear someone who cares, who gives her full time to the job, who is thoughtful, deliberate, and takes all the little details into account. to oversimplify this race, I guess the outsiders would say Penny and fellow incumbent Julie Thomas are too deliberate, too deferential to the loudest voices, and too focused on the little details to see the big picture, while the current commissioner's retort is essentially, it's very easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but when you had to sit in the big chair, you have to account for all of the variables, you have to check all the little boxes, and you have to balance many competing interests. It is a fine line to walk. As I said at the top of this episode, I've begun to make sense of the divisions in the local party, which both reflect and diverge from divisions in the Democratic Party at the national level. In Washington, think about the centrist versus progressive split. Corporate Democrats versus justice Democrats. The Pelosi, Schumer, Biden, old guard neoliberals versus Democratic socialists like Bernie Sanders, AOC, and the Squad. Support for the two camps is largely, but not entirely, divided along generational lines. So let's zoom out. I've mentioned this before, but the nature of single-member districts with winner-take-all voting almost ensures a two-party system. In political science, this is called Duverger's Law. So, the two parties each consist of multiple interest groups held together in coalition. As those interest groups move in and out of the parties, the dynamic of the parties changes. For example, from the 1930s, party lines had basically been drawn on the economic axis: big business Republicans and working class Democrats. As the Democratic Party came to fully embrace the civil rights movement in the 1960s, Southern conservatives and rural voters who had been in league with ethnic urban working class voters began to leave the party as Goldwater, Nixon, and then Reagan invited the racists to jump ship and become Republicans. Party lines were redrawn on the social axis. Those who, in a previous generation, may have been liberal Republicans, which, as ridiculous as it sounds now, was absolutely a thing, were turned off by the GOP's far-right turn and went on to become Atari Democrats, New Democrats, Blue Dog Democrats, Clinton Democrats, centrists by many names. So zoom back in. As essentially a one-party jurisdiction, Bloomington and Monroe County make an interesting case study. The parties are still organized on social issues. As an open, tolerant, welcoming community, we here in Monroe County all basically agree on the culture war stuff. Cultural conservative Republicans are not going to win here, period. So, if the Chamber of Commerce wants any influence, they've got to cultivate some business-friendly Democrats. It appears that's where Iverson and Madeira and their fundraising advantage come in. This is the window through which I've been viewing this race. But still, I feel like it's not that simple. For one, the generational divide isn't right. At the national level, you've got the older corporate Democrats standing in the way of younger progressives. Here, you've got the slick, business-backed younger challengers trying to overthrow, and this got an affirmative laugh from Penny off-air, a couple of old hippies. So, I've still got my finger to the wind. There's one more chance to get to the bottom of this race. I talked to five-term Bloomington City Council member Steve Volan, the final Democrat in this primary, and will post my interview with him in the coming days. But for now, thanks for listening. Thank you to my guest today, County Commissioner Penny Githens. You can find her at pennygithensforcommissioner.com. As for me, You can find me on Facebook, Blue Sky, YouTube, and TikTok at Who's Left, and on most other social media sites at ScottRoch78. If you want to reach me, send me a DM on the socials or email me at ScottRoch78@gmail.com. If you haven't subscribed yet, when you're finished here, please go to ScottAaronRogers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level if you can. Help me keep this project going. Until next time, this has been the Who's Left Podcast. I'm Scott Aaron Rogers. Love each other, Indiana. We'll be right back.